going to be on, well, I think it's quite an interesting topic in gravity, namely gravitational instantons. So an instanton is a solution to Euclidean, actually, but a solution to the field equations in Euclidean time, and it's thought to represent a quantum mechanical type of tunneling process. So we've, although most of the course has been about sort of honest-to-God regular gravitational physics, we have thought a little bit about quantum aspects of gravity, at least in, we've taken baby steps. We're not trying to quantize gravity. We're just trying to think of ways in which we can use what we know to deduce things about some quantum aspects or quantum phenomena within the context of gravity. So with thermodynamics, we kind of thought that was more thinking about taking some fixed background and looking at aspects of field theory on that background. I know that's not the way we did it, but it certainly can be properly set up that way. This is a bit different. This is actually including gravity in the process. So it's saying that gravity is sort of participating in something that we would identify as a quantum mechanical process. So, you know, how can that be? Well, as we'll sort of see in the story here, the reason it can be is because in tunneling, which is, after all, something that really is inherently quantum mechanical, we'll find that the exact sort of expression for some sort of tunneling amplitude can be approximated by a leading order effect. So this is basically doing a WKB type of approximation to, in this case, the Schrödinger equation. And once you take this leading order approximation, you've introduced a sort of notion of saddle points and hence a notion of classical solutions. So that's kind of why we can think about taking this, this approximation or using this calculation to say something about tunneling. So the reason kind of this is interesting is that what I'm going to talk about is based, so I guess I'll review in detail some papers that appeared in the late 70s and early 80s, which are called Fate of the False Vacuum. They're by Coleman and collaborators. And what they did was considered a situation where our vacuum, or a vacuum, was not stable. So I'll try and discuss what that means. So it's perturbatively stable, but nonetheless, it's a local minimum and not a global minimum. And so they wanted to think about a tunneling process whereby you got a phase transition by a bubble of real vacuum nucleating inside the false vacuum. So at the time, they were interested in phase transitions in the early universe. So this is about the time that inflation was sort of bubbling around. And the idea then was we have a period of rapid expansion, we have some cosmological constant, we need to get rid of it, we need a phase transition. And so the initial attempt was via a first order phase transition. So that's a discontinuous change of order parameter. So in this case, that was achieved by tunneling. And so since you're dealing with the universe, you have to think about including gravity. However, now we find it's got new relevance because if we just stick within the standard model, then it seems as if our Higgs vacuum is actually just like the old inflationary vacuum. It's only metastable. Obviously, it's perturbatively stable because we're here, but if you actually follow the Higgs quartic coupling up to very high energies, you find that it turns negative, at least within the standard model. So that means you have to think about tunneling processes. And so what are the probabilities of these tunneling processes? You could calculate them within the field theory, but you know, given that once you take into account a vacuum energy, you've got a cosmological constant, it makes sense to include gravity. So that's kind of the rationale, the story. And the reason why it's of interest is because sort of right at the end, I'll just say a few words about some recent work that I've been doing which includes black holes into the process, and it seems as if primordial black holes can dramatically change the conclusions about tunneling from the false vacuum. So in order to motivate this Euclidean approach, what I want to do is just talk a little bit about a very familiar example of tunneling, which is simple Schrödinger equation and a square barrier. So we know from a classical perspective, if we were to throw marbles against a square barrier like that, that they wouldn't get over, except possibly if we'd somehow slammed them in so hard they jumped up and randomly went over. So, but if they've only got some energy which is less than that barrier, they're going to just bounce back. Quantum mechanically, on the other hand, if anything can happen, it will, just maybe with very small probability. So the particle can actually have some measure, some wave function under the barrier. It's just that it's quite suppressed. So I've sort of sketched this cartoon here, represents what happens. So on the left-hand side, you have sort of regular wave functions going to the left, to the right, and to the left. But on the right-hand side, you also have a real sort of particle going to the right, and underneath you actually get a combination of exponentially suppressed and growing solutions, which overall, when you do the matching conditions, gives you this amplitude for transmission. So if the barrier is relatively small, you can see that we have to worry about the full structure of the wave function under the barrier. But if the barrier is reasonably big, and by that we're actually talking about this omega d here, then it's a good approximation. If omega d is large, it's a good approximation to just take this exponential factor. So that's the approximation that we're working within. And so what is omega? Well, omega is like the imaginary frequency of our wave function under the barrier, and it's simply related to the difference between the particle energy and the barrier height. So this is what you get for omega from the Schrödinger equation, but I'm also choosing to write it down as an integral under the barrier of this potential difference, the square root of the potential difference, okay? So what's that got to do with Euclidean dynamics? So let's sort of take a different look at the problem. So to some extent, this is, at some level, it's a bit like a trick. It's something where you look at the Schrödinger equation, you know, you do a WKB approximation, you kind of notice that what you're doing in real time has an interpretation if you analytically continue to Euclidean time. So let's just look at a different problem. So what I'm going to consider is part a class. Just step aside for a moment and consider classical particle motion in a potential well. So it's going to be roughly, essentially a square well. The height of it, let's call it delta V. And the kinetic energy of the particle, or the velocity of the particle, is given by this delta V. So I'm kind of assuming, ignoring the mass here. So if I have a particle at the top here, you could think that it'll fall down, and the steeper it is, obviously, the faster it falls. It gets to the bottom, it moves across. In a perfect world, it doesn't lose any energy. And it shoots up to the top on the other side. So that's kind of what it's doing to some approximation. So now let me consider the integral of root 2 delta v dx. So you can see now where I'm beginning to try and make contact with the other problem. Now, because x dot squared is 2 delta v, I can replace dx by x dot dt, and that gives me another root 2 delta v. So I get just the integral of 2 delta v dt, or I suppose I should say d tau in this case. But then, for this particle, I can rewrite this as the integral of a half x dot squared plus delta v. But this is really just an integral of an action, a sort of Euclidean action, okay? So if I look at my classical action, say the Lagrangian of a classical particle moving in a potential, that kind of goes to if I Euclideanize my time, t goes to I tau. So I can just kind of rewrite everything. All I've done here is sort of repackaged things. And you see that the sort of shape of the Lagrangian in Euclidean time is actually a half x prime squared minus v. So it's as if motion of a particle in a potential v. So if the v is the real potential, if I analytically continue to imaginary time, it looks like an inverted potential. So applying this to the setup that we had for the particle tunneling through the barrier, so in this case, if I just looked at my simple tunneling in the square barrier, I saw that by taking a Euclidean process, so I invert my well and think about classical dynamics in Euclidean time, I can identify the exponent as an integral of an action. So now I want to do the same thing in terms of a more general tunneling process where I'm stuck, say, in this is like alpha decay, I'm stuck in this local minimum, and I kind of expect that I'll be able to tunnel out. So I invert my potential to get this shape. The ball is just representing kind of where we are. We're a classical particle. What might a classical particle do here? It'll roll off. It'll go up to the point where it's a turning point, where its sort of kinetic energy has gone back to zero, and then it goes back again, and then at t goes to plus infinity, it goes back to this, well, in this case, an unstable point. Now, obviously, if we were doing real dynamics, that would be a very unrealistic trajectory, okay? So it's not something that we would expect to happen in real physical dynamics of real particles. However, as a solution to equations of motion, that is a legitimate solution to equations of motion. It starts here at t goes to minus infinity. It gradually, you know, very slowly begins to tipple down, falls down, goes up the other side, pauses, comes back. So from this perspective, this is that point of emergence. So the idea is that we have a particle here in real time. It has this sort of Euclidean trajectory. It emerges here, and then it goes down. So that's a sort of description. The Euclidean part of it doesn't really have a direct interpretation or any way that we can describe it in terms of classical physics. It's a way of thinking about how the particle gets out. But what it's mirroring is, if you took the wave function of the particle, it's mirroring the exponential tail that exists under the barrier. So the example that we're going to apply it to, that's just given some sort of justification for how the Euclidean process works. I mean, we have a very good rationale for using it in the context of standard quantum mechanics with a Schrödinger equation. So when it comes to field theory, what we're going to do is we're going to transport some of this learning process into the context of field theory. So we're going to use it to try and describe false vacuum decay. So one of the questions I often get is, what is a false vacuum? Because it's sort of, I'll try and describe that. So here we have our standard looking Lagrangian for a scalar field. Scalars are always our go-to toy when we're trying to describe a process. So we've seen a double well potential. So let me just, initially at least, take a situation where I just take my double well and I'm just going to bump it a bit. I'm going to make one side go down and the other side go up. So I now have, if I exaggerate, a little difference, epsilon, in the two heights of the two minima. So what that means is that if we were to try and pick a vacuum like we normally do, we pick either one or the other and quantize around it, provided we only ever did things either at low energies or localized in time, we wouldn't actually be aware, if we picked the left vacuum, that we picked the wrong one. We hadn't picked a global vacuum until we either waited long enough that something happened, the particle hopped into the other minimum, Or if we looked at very high energy states, which would naturally be able to sample the other half of the potential. So that's why it's called a false vacuum, because it looks like the vacuum, at least for low-lying states. It's very close to looking, being the same as the unperturbed, the untilted double well potential. So in this case, I've zeroed V actually at zero. So our false vacuum is something that has a vacuum energy, and our true vacuum does not. The true vacuum is the global minimum in that potential. So here, our false vacuum, we would expect to be metastable, given our intuition from quantum mechanics. So we wouldn't expect that if we, you know, if we put a particle here with a very low energy, we wouldn't expect it to always be there. So that's what we mean. That's sort of kind of what we mean by metastability, false and true vacuum. So what we're going to do is we're going to import this trick from looking at quantum mechanical tunneling into field theory and say, let's look for a Euclidean solution. Let's just see what happens. Okay, so all I've done there is I've looked at my equation of motion. I've kind of gone through and changed the signs in order to Euclideanize it. And then I've written down what dv d phi is. So this ought to be looking somewhat familiar in the sense that if I ignored the epsilon piece, that's the sort of bit that you get when we did the domain wall. And I guess, you know, on the left-hand side, you've got a double derivative. At the moment, it's an overall Laplacian in 4D, but it's still a double derivative. So let's look for a solution. Which is completely spherically symmetric. So it's kind of, to some extent, it's an assumption, but it's a well-reasoned assumption to say that, you know, typically solutions, the simplest solutions, the lowest energy solutions to things tend to be as symmetric as possible. So we're going to look for a solution which is spherically symmetric. So here's what we've got. This is a sketch. This is our Euclidean time. This is meant to represent the spatial directions. And so my solution is going to be dependent on rho. So rho squared is going to be tau squared plus the spatial direction squared. And I'm going to say that the bubble has radius rho naught. So if I put in that assumption into my, yep. Thank you. Yes, there is a typo. Thank you very much. Yep. Typo. So if I first of all transform to that spherically symmetric situation and look at things in terms of my rho coordinate, the distance from the origin, then my left-hand side becomes a Laplacian in hyperspherical coordinates. So I get the standard sort of d minus 1 over rho piece there. On the right-hand side, I'm now going to make use of the fact that we're going to assume epsilon is small. So I'm following these early papers of Coleman and collaborators, which at the time, of course, nowadays we just can easily bung the equation on a computer. It's not a big deal to try and find an exact solution. But obviously, if you want to do it on the board, or if you're working back in the 1970s when computing was a little bit more of a big deal, you tried to not use, you know, you try to do analytic arguments wherever possible. So, epsilon small. I'm going to start off by ignoring it and seeing where I get. So, this is really something I recognize, or it should be that you recognize it now too. If I blotted that out, 3 on rho, I have the domain wall. So, if I can ignore that second derivative on the left-hand side, then it's exactly the domain wall. So the domain wall solution would be this sort of tangent solution. And so can I ignore that extra piece? Well, we know that the tanh varies near rho naught, and it varies relatively rapidly on a scale set by root lambda eta. So provided that that root lambda eta is big, and provided that rho naught is big, then this is a good approximation. So that's really kind of what we're saying. Root lambda eta is kind of setting the scale of the width of the wall, so rho naught has to be big compared to that. So as the idea here now is if we look now at tau, what's going on? As tau goes to minus infinity, we're in the false vacuum. So one thing that this does not look like is actually this bounce here, because the bounce here is something that starts from false, goes to true, and goes back again. But of course, this was just one dimension, one spatial dimension. Whereas we're now in three spatial dimensions. If we try to kind of roll everywhere in space, we're going to be sort of hitting a problem. But we want to still have this notion of a bounce. So let's see if that's what we get. T goes to minus infinity, we're in the false vacuum. We now move forward in Euclidean time, and in a finite region of space, our field rolls into the true vacuum, maximizes the region in which it's rolled, and then as we move forward, it rolls back to the false vacuum again. So it is a bounce type of structure. It's just that it's kind of a bounce in a finite region. Question?
Dimensional, just say we ignore the grot squared of phi, we only do like the stacking in the tau direction. So
that would then, right, so that would represent something different. And the problem you'd have there is if you try and do this bounce sort of everywhere in space, you're going to end up with an infinite action. So by localizing the region in which you roll to the true vacuum, or at least to the exit point and back again, that keeps the action finite. So that's basically, you know, the reason why it has, at least within this description, it has this structure. So let me just put what I said into words. Tau goes to minus infinity. So it is bouncing, it's just that the region which moves to true vacuum is localized. And the reason for that is just to have finite action.
Mm-hmm. How do we know that the true vacuum is represented by that region and the full vacuum is around that region?
You mean why is it round? Well, I was always saying when I said we expect spherical symmetry. So in reality, let me get to computing the action, and then I'll make a comment about it at that point. So if I forget, ask me again, because I think it'll make more sense in the context of discussing the tunneling amplitude to answer the question, okay?
And why do we know that the true vacuum region is like in the middle of like the full vacuum region?
It's coordinate choice. It's completely independent. I can move that bubble wherever I want. So it's just gauge. It's not, there's no physics, at least for the single bubble, moving it around. So that's simply, I have chosen my coordinates to be centered. It's just like when you do the bounce in 1+1 dimensions, you would choose t equals 0 to be the turning point. It's just convenience, really. Okay, so the domain wall . So it's an approximation, but it's actually quite a good approximation if we have the sort of potential that I've sketched. And just sort of thinking about, if we remember the way it or how it looks, it actually is representing a rapid variation between the false and true vacuum. So that wall is thin, if you like, relative to the size of the bubble. So let me carry on doing that Euclidean action computation. So this would be my action. It's the kinetic term continued to Euclidean time and the potential minus the potential. Now this piece here is d phi by d rho squared, just by, you know, changing coordinates. But then if I look one of the properties of the domain wall is that, in fact, if you remember when we wrote the solution down, we noticed that the phi prime had a sort of sech squared in it, and if we evaluated v, it was like sech to the fourth. So, in fact, phi prime squared is roughly too good. I mean, it's exactly 2v for the domain wall, but what it means is that if we try and correct the wall for the geometric, you know, the sort of three on row piece, we will get still, this will still hold true. And even if we include the epsilon in, this should still be approximately true. So therefore, our action is essentially the integral of 2v d4x. So if I now just try and interpret what that means, that integral, for the V naught, the double well potential, that potential is only non-zero throughout the wall. And if you remember, the tension of the wall or the energy per unit area of the wall is given by the integral of this, the V through the barrier. So here we've got the wall tension. So that's like integrating with respect to a transverse coordinate through the wall. And then we've got to integrate around the other three directions of the wall, and that gives us an area. So overall, the action of the wall part is just the tension of the wall times the area of the bubble. But to get the action of our instanton, our solution, what we have to do is we say, well, you know, we've also got to take into account the fact that the vacuum has energy. So the background, false vacuum, in some sense, you know, if we integrated V over the whole of space, that would be infinite. So the action of our instanton is kind of the difference between what the background is and what that solution gives. So in essence, what we're doing, the formation of this bubble is changing the setup. We're losing energy by having to make the wall, but we're gaining energy from the fact that inside the bubble we've gone from false to true vacuum. So really what I was calculating here was the Euclidean action of the wall. So by having created the bubble, what we've done is we've cost ourselves energy by making a wall, but we've gained energy by making the inside not be in the true vacuum. So you can see there's sort of an energy payoff going on here. If, you know, relative surface area relative to volume inside, if the bubble's too small, it kind of, we've spent too much on the wall trying to create it. If it's too big, there's too much of an overall cost in actually making it in the first place. So there's kind of the just right situation where, you know, we get the best payoff for making the wall in terms of energy gain from exiting the false vacuum. So our bounce action should say energy in inverted commas, because of course we're all Euclidean here. Right, so our bounce action is going to be the difference between the wall action and the energy gain from the transition. So I've simply written down what those are. We calculated what the action of the wall was, and I've just written down the volume term for the inside of the bubble. So now, given that the wall is a solution to the equations of motion, so that means it's a stationary point of the action. So if I take, I've written my action in terms of bubble radius. In essence, what I've really done is I've said, I know my action depends on my scalar field, which means, you know, it's got lots of degrees of freedom, but the key degree of freedom of all of this infinite amount of excitations, et cetera, that you can do of the scalar field, the key degree of freedom is the size of the bubble. So I've kind of integrated out everything else because it's not relevant, and I'm focusing in on what happens as I vary the size of the bubble. So if I take dB d rho naught, and set it to naught, I find rho naught is equal to 3 sigma on epsilon. So the smaller epsilon, the less difference there is between the two sides, the bigger rho naught is. Bigger the tension of the wall, the bigger rho naught is. So this gives me a bounce action dependent on a prefactor times the something dependent on the tension of the wall and the difference between the vacua. So that is the Euclidean solution to field theory. And if I ask what happens in a real-time picture, I simply analytically continue back. Now my bubble is at fixed rho. So in other words, it's at fixed x squared minus t squared in Lorentzian time. And so what this does is take us back to our picture of the domain wall, where if you remember, I claimed that space was flat and the wall kind of looked like a hyperboloid because intrinsically it had a sort of de Sitter type of geometry, constant curvature geometry. So obviously this would be a wall existing for all time, but we're trying to describe a phase transition. So if we cut our solution at t equals zero here and say that in some sense, what we do is we sort of patch on the Euclidean solution or half of the Euclidean solution. Again, the Euclidean solution doesn't have a real-time interpretation. It's just a sort of way of thinking about it. We have a completely false vacuum, and then at t equals naught, a bubble of true vacuum nucleates, static, stationary, and then starts to accelerate and expands. So that's the picture of a transition from one phase to a new phase. And gradually the bubble expands in Lorentzian space, and sort of eventually, you know, we have completed a phase transition. So that's the sort of field theory picture. But of course, I've completely neglected gravity here. Well, again, we've done all the work pretty much to actually understand what happens when we include gravity. If we include gravity with this picture, we have a cosmological constant. So it's basically V of phi, false vacuum in the case that I've discussed here. But if you have a difference in vacuum energy, it means one cosmological constant is different from the other cosmological constant. And so what this means is that we are going to have our background is either de Sitter, Minkowski, or anti-de Sitter, and the true vacuum is likewise. But it has a different lambda. So let me just discuss what Coleman and De Lucia looked at, which was the situation where the false vacuum had a positive cosmological constant and the true vacuum had none. So we're tunneling from De Sitter space to Minkowski space. So we tunnel from De Sitter to Minkowski. So gravitationally, Euclidean De Sitter is an S4. So it looks like this, crudely speaking. And in this case, our cosmological constant, our length scale of De Sitter, which is 3 over lambda, sets the radius of our sphere, Euclidean De Sitter space. So our Lorentzian De Sitter space is just a hyperboloid, same sort of radius of curvature. And so we apply Israel conditions to patch this De Sitter space to flat space. So in essence, we're saying, as before, we're going to take a sort of spherically symmetric solution. Inside, we've got flat space. And then outside, we've got something that's more like the rho squared plus sine squared rho. Got something that looks like a sphere, four-sphere. So we go through the Israel process. We put our wall at rho naught with our normal d by d rho. We We calculate the extrinsic curvatures. And then we write, here I've actually written it in terms of a row coordinate, but we can simply do the same thing, except I've written it with different coordinates here, how annoyingly. And so when we match, we find that we're given a specific radius. So our matching conditions give a specific radius for a given tension. So this is now different from what happened for the pure field theory, because in the pure field theory, we had to do this sort of variation of the bounce action to decide how big the wall was. Here, gravity is telling us how big the wall can be, because the tension of the wall is setting the jump in extrinsic curvature, and the jump in extrinsic curvature is actually sort of set by the radius of the bubble. So I haven't at the moment written down the tension of the wall because I haven't put in I haven't used the Israel conditions yet. So the thing that's annoying me is I've got a different gauge in my notes to what I've started writing here. So I'm trying to do the translation on the fly, and there's a chance that there'll be some sort of typographical sort of niggly inconsistency in it. So as long as you're prepared to forgive that. Let me change, because I was trying to give a sort of continuous type of description, but of course, if I write it this way, then when I identify across when I patch two spaces together, the induced metric absolutely has to be the same, and of course, that's not going to be the case here. So let me rewrite this as, change coordinates. So you've got a match now, rho naught with L sine chi, so apologies for that. And over here, this would just be chi naught. And so here, rho naught is L sine chi naught. That's what we've got to have to match across the wall. So this is my tension. I'm given a specific rho naught because at the moment, there's a bit of algebra that has to be done to unravel the expression, because it's rho naught is L sine chi naught. But you can see on the left-hand side, I've got some expression involving rho naught, and on the right-hand side, I've got sigma. So then what we do is we have to take the bounce action and we do what we did for the pure field theory case. We take the action of the solution and take a background subtraction. So in essence, we're really just sort of taking the, in this case, it's the same sort of thing. We're taking the energy of the wall and what we've gained from the interior of the wall, except now, of course, we have to take our Einstein action. So I'm just going to sort of say what it is, that because we've gone from de Sitter, false vacuum, to true vacuum, we have to take what we've gained. This would be the energy of de Sitter inside chi naught. We've then got to account for the wall. So that's the sigma, but we've also got the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term that we also have to add in. So you do that, and what you get is this following answer for the action. So you can see that it goes like sigma to the fourth, which is what we got for the flat action. And then you see the 1 over epsilon cubed because you've got sort of an L to the sixth on the top. So when you send G goes to zero, you kind of have to stare at it a little bit, but you do in fact get the field theory result. So we can sketch our instanton, looks something like this. It's the foresphere truncated at chi naught. And that's sort of, you've chopped the side of the sphere off and put a flat Minkowski geometry. So that's the background false vacuum decay process. So in 2 minutes or 3 minutes, let me just sort of say what happens with adding a black hole. So you can do this whether you're tunneling from de Sitter to flat, de Sitter to Sitter, de Sitter to anti-de Sitter, flat to anti-de, whatever. You know, you can tunnel between any two different vacua. So when you add a black hole, there are all sort of some interesting things happen from the Euclidean point of view. So we know from a Euclidean perspective, black holes have a temperature, which means that the horizon has a natural periodicity. Which is like one sort of, you know, black hole periodicity. The problem that you have if you try and do this description for de Sitter, if you add a black hole to de Sitter, is that de Sitter also has a natural periodicity in static coordinates. So this is related to the fact that there's a sort of natural temperature associated with de Sitter space because an exponentially expanding universe has horizons. And as soon as you have horizons, you have temperatures. So in essence, you know, it looks slightly perplexing, but what we did was we came up with a prescription for actually dealing with conical singularities that kind of gave us a consistent way of computing the action. It kind of didn't matter on whether you'd, you know, whatever periodicity you'd actually chosen. So instead of having, you know, in static coordinates, you know, it's a different analytic continuation from the sort of Coleman-de Lucia But we've kind of got something that looks like this, where we have Minkowski space-time and we have a cosmological horizon. So that's kind of one way of thinking about it. So the headline of this was that the action that we found could, in principle, be much less than Coleman-De Lucia. So that means that the, you know, in principle, these things could seed a vacuum decay if you now apply it to the Higgs vacuum. So just to summarize, is if you actually, this is almost standard model, so it doesn't matter if I carry on, does it? So in terms of the Higgs vacuum, we're going to be tunneling from lambda equals zero to lambda less than zero. But we use exactly the same formalism. It's the same steps, same idea. And we get the same sort of result. The only wrinkle fly in the ointment is that to get large suppression, large suppression of B and therefore enhancement of tunneling, so your probability is going like e to the minus b, you have to have, so you have small tension, but this is really small tension with respect to Planck scales, so that's not such a problem, but you also need small black holes. And so what what we find is that you need to have black holes that are not astrophysical, but instead are sort of getting towards the Planck scale, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 or so Planck masses. So then we have to worry about comparing it to Hawking evaporation. So we had to do a comparison between the different ways a black hole can cause problems. And just roughly speaking, if this is the mass of the black hole over the Planck mass, and here's sort of one, and we're looking at the, I suppose this is a log-log plot actually, the decay rate over the Hawking evaporation rate, then we did actually find, if this is also one, that for quite a wide range of scales, tunneling is preferred to evaporation. So we're kind of plotting there the branching ratio between tunneling decay and evaporation decay. And it's, if you, instead of doing thin wall, you actually integrate it up, we're sort of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 Planck mass black hole. So we're sort of at just below 10 to the 15 GeV scale there. So it's a little bit kind of, you know, pushing our semi-classical description, but nonetheless, it's kind of an interesting notion that, you know, maybe primordial black holes could be problematic, but no doubt something will happen to the standard model instead to actually stabilize our vacuum, which should probably be a somewhat more desirable effect. But nonetheless, I think what's interesting about this is typically we kind of imagine sort of gravitational physics not really having so much to do with particle physics, except if we go to very high energies or think about string theory. And I guess what I like about this is it's saying that, no, in fact, maybe the two can talk to each other in a, or at least have something to say at a more mundane level. Okay.